children should live like other children in the world, away from danger and destruction. It is their right in life to live as children in a safe place, a place that gives them something to live a normal life.
Palestinian kids say they feel happy when Sami paints their faces. The Israeli regime launched this devastating onslaught on Gaza in early May. At least 256 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed during the 11-day war.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New York prosecutors may soon bring indictment against Trump Organization tied to perks for top executives, says David Smith, author, in an article published under the heading, Trump in Financial and Political Danger as Company Faces Possible Criminal Charges. Stay tuned for more. Donald Trump is facing a potentially crippling financial and political blow as the state's prosecutors consider filing criminal charges against his family business recently. Prosecutors in New York could soon bring an indictment against the Trump Organization related to the taxation of lucrative perks that it gave to top executives, such as use of apartments, cars, and school tuition. The 45th president is not expected to be personally charged, but the legal drama could bankrupt his company by damaging his relationships with banks and other business partners, as well as clouding his political comeback. Ron Fischetti, a lawyer for the Trump Organization, held a virtual meeting with prosecutors recently for about 90 minutes in an effort to dissuade them from pursuing criminal charges against the company. The charges are absolutely outrageous and unprecedented. If needed, the charges are filed, Fischetti told the Associated Press recently, adding, this is just to get back at Donald Trump. We are going to plead not guilty and we will make a motion to dismiss. Fischetti and his colleagues had to make their final arguments against charges being brought, according to a report in the Washington Post. The long-running investigation by Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan district attorney, began after Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, paid hush money ahead of the 2016 presidential election to two women who alleged that they had sexual encounters with Trump. Trump denies the claim, however. There is now a particular focus on Alan Weisselberg, 73, the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, the private real estate conglomerate. Prosecutors are examining his son Barry's use of a Trump apartment at little or no cost, cars leased for the family, and tuition payments made to a school attended by Weisselberg's grandchildren. Such gifts and perks are worth tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. If the Weisselberg failed to account properly for that money on tax returns and other financial filings, they could be in legal jeopardy. But Fischetti insists that any criminal charges based on fringe benefits would represent a speculative break from precedent. We looked back 100 years of cases, and we haven't found one in which an employee has been indicted for fringe benefits, and certainly not a corporation, he told the AP, adding, to be a crime, it would have to be for the benefit of the corporation with the knowledge of the corporation. They don't have the evidence at all. Even so, a point of intrigue is whether Weisselberg will remain loyal to the former president or turn informant, potentially testifying against Trump, the company's owner, his son Don Jr. and Eric, who are executive vice presidents, and his daughter Ivanka. Trump, beaten by Joe Biden in last November's election, has long sought to dismiss the investigation as a witch hunt and remains politically active. He returned to campaign rallies, intends to be heavily involved in the 2022 midterm elections, and could run for president again in 2024. But there are signs that the walls are closing in. Vance, investigating possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct, has been scrutinizing Trump's tax records, subpoenaing documents, and interviewing witnesses, including Trump insiders and company executives. A grand jury was recently empaneled to look at the evidence. Meanwhile, Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, said she was assigning two lawyers to work with Vance on the criminal investigation while she continues her own civil investigation of Trump's business. James' office has been examining whether the Trump Organization inflated the values of some properties to obtain better terms on loans and lowered their values to obtain property tax breaks. Court records show some overlap between Vance and James' separate investigations, including their interest in Seven Springs, a 212-acre estate outside Manhattan that Trump purchased in 1995. James is examining a $21.1 million tax deduction taken when Trump agreed not to develop the property after local opposition thwarted his plan to build a golf course, and a separate plan to build luxury homes was shelved. Trump has angrily denounced both investigations. In a statement released recently, he claimed the case was an extension of the Democrats' witch hunt against him. They will do anything to stop the MAGA movement and me, he said, referring to the Make America Great Again campaign slogan, and insisting that the Trump Organization had merely done things that are standard practice throughout the U.S. business community and in no way a crime. The ex-president added, having politically motivated prosecutors, people who actually got elected because they will get Donald Trump, is a very dangerous thing for our country. In the end, people will not stand for it. Remember, if they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone, unquote. Trump's loss of power in Washington now deprives him, his family, and his company of legal protections he enjoyed while in the White House. The District of Columbia Attorney General's office, for example, is suing the Trump Organization and Presidential Inaugural Committee over the alleged misuse of more than $1 million for use of event space at the Trump Hotel in Washington during Trump's inauguration in January 2017. Ivanka, who was a senior advisor at the White House, sat for a deposition with investigators last December, but is in no imminent danger of criminal charges.
We give people. U.S. healthcare.
According to official estimates, there are around 30 million people without health insurance in the United States. There's no universal healthcare program, and health insurance is mostly just another product set to be marketed and sold in the free market.
Imagine you're in America. Which of these options would be best for you?
That's a lot to think about.
What is an Oop Max?
I guess with what I got here, I would go with Plan D because the deductible is zero.
Okay, there's more.
Gold HMO, PPO, PPO HMO.
And what are copays? I don't get... That's like if you pay for Spotify Premium, and Spotify still makes you pay every time you listen to a song.
Welcome to We The People. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi, and in this episode, we will take a look at the controversy at the heart of healthcare in the United States. We will also delve into the issue of insurance, which is a profitable business and therefore plays a major role in the politics of the United States.
You know what the major problem with American healthcare is? It's paperwork.
Are you kidding me? 10 or 12 pages?
V-O-H-C.
Do I have any glasses?
Going to check right now.
Shit.
Excellent.
Okay, let's talk about Obamacare.
We will.
Sure?
Yeah. All right, let me just take a look here. A typical insurance on an initial visit like this, which takes me 1 hour, pays about $100 or $95. The cost for that hour for me to just keep the office open and operating is about $300.
So when insurance is actually paying for it, they're not paying you enough.
They pay me a lot less than the visit is worth.
Healthcare coverage is mostly provided through a private health insurance. There is, of course, the limited public health coverage, such as Medicare and Medicaid. Efforts to get the country closer to a comprehensive healthcare program have all been shut down by those promoting the idea that healthcare should also be subject to competition in the market. But is healthcare something the people want the government to provide, or is it something to shop for?
What do you think about socialized healthcare?
I do not like the idea of that.
I don't want the government picking what I can and cannot do.
Well, my husband's from Europe, so I think it's pretty good, actually. I think a lot of people are covered by it. Everybody's covered. They don't have to worry about paying for it.
It's definitely more accessible for everybody. It allows all of us to remain healthy, to live long lives as much as we can.
I think it's kind of a necessity that the government provides healthcare for its citizens.
If everybody has something for free, who's going to pay for it?
Okay, what if people pay for it by taxes? What do you think of that?
Well, that's going to increase. You like to pay taxes?
Regardless of where the everyday American stands on the issue, a never-ending political debate is underway to address the matter. And of course, as always, some power play is also at work. Our first guest is Dr. Anna Malinov, a clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of California, and the co-organizer for the Working Group for National Single-Payer Healthcare. Welcome to the show, Dr. Malinov.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. First of all, generally speaking, do you think healthcare is a right or is it a product open to competition in the free market?
Well, there are two ways to answer your question. Do I believe that healthcare is a human right? Yes, I strongly believe this. But generally speaking, is healthcare considered a right in the United States? And I would have to say, sadly, that it is not. A right cannot be based on your ability to pay, as is the case here. A right cannot and should not be based on your race or on your class, and that is the case here.
Very well. Thank you for your insight, Dr. Malinow.
Today, the United States remains with no universal healthcare program, unlike most other developed countries. Therefore, it ranks only among the first 30 countries when it comes to healthcare access and healthcare quality. With prices specified in the open market, costs for medicines and healthcare depend on market forces rather than the government. In the other developed nations, however, there are governmental programs aimed at partially controlling costs relating to healthcare.
What's an average medical bill for, you know, a regular Texan? How much might that person be paying for their premium and their regular bill?
Let's say you break your arm. Regularly in the rest of the world, that's a couple hundred dollars. Here in Texas, easily $2,000, $3,000.
Could I ask you then to guess how much it might cost in the UK if you broke your arm, that situation? How much do you think someone has to pay in order to have that fixed?
$200.
It's totally free.
Totally free.
Wow.
I can tell you. I've got a busted shoulder, and I can tell you exactly how much it cost.
You mind?
Yeah, sure. It was $5,000 just to have a doctor look at my broken collarbone. Just
right.
To look at my broken collarbone.
You had to pay that on the rival?
No. My insurance covered the majority of it, but my portion of it was about just shy of three.
Wow.
So if you ask the people, many would complain about the expensive costs of healthcare in their country. Hospitals, doctors, and nurses charge more, and if the costs are on the rise due to market forces, the government is in no position to have a say. We're now joined by Life Malcolm, a community organizer based in Tampa, Florida. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, as a developed nation, why does the United States still lack the universal healthcare system?
So that's a very interesting kind of question. Whether it's a right or something in the, you know, competition in the free market, it's a really dynamic question. And I say that because I don't know if there's, you know, if it's a right or not. Maybe it is, you know, because rights seem to presuppose somebody's authorization of the occurrence or something. But what I do know is healthcare is a necessity.
Very well. Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Life Malcolm. Stay tuned as we have more.
Lack of healthcare was particularly tough during the COVID-19 pandemic. Over 30 million cases of the novel coronavirus have so far been reported across the United States, and 600,000 Americans have died due to COVID-19 infection.
The emergence of the Delta variant, which has now been found in many states across the United States, does pose a challenge to our collective efforts to squash COVID once and for all. That being said, we need not react to the Delta variant. We can act now. Thankfully, the vaccines that we have available have shown great effectiveness against, including the Delta variant. The best thing that folks can do right now who are concerned about this is take the clear step of going out and getting vaccinated and keeping themselves and their families safe.
The Delta variant of the coronavirus is rapidly spreading across the country, so much so that it will likely become the dominant COVID-19 strain in the United States, according to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. A higher percentage of all new doses are expected to be from the Delta variant, which first appeared in India and is now rapidly spreading across the world.
Healthcare has always played a significant role in politics in the United States, and if you look at the last few electoral cycles in the United States, healthcare has been most prominent in the electoral politics. And when polled, most Americans support expanding Medicare for all. Yet politicians who are put into office by those very same companies that make a huge profit from the healthcare system are the ones that are writing policy. And they are the ones that are not writing the policy that we need and that we deserve in this country for single-payer Medicare for all. So if it's up to the politicians, we'll never achieve single-payer national health care. That's why it's up to us, the people, to make it happen.
While the majority of Americans have been vaccinated, vaccine hesitancy remains a serious issue. Some would assume now that with the vaccinations continuing, the rates of infection would automatically drop. Yet, in reality, a whole lot is left to be studied about the Delta variant, and some reports warn that it could even result in a rise in the number of doses come this fall.
This variant's probably 40 to 60% more infective, more contagious than the 117 variant, that UK variant that became prevalent in the United States and caused that surge in the late spring. It doesn't necessarily appear more pathogenic, meaning more dangerous, but it's infecting people more easily, and it's starting to become very prevalent in the UK in communities that are unvaccinated. Connecticut, for example, where I am, shows no upsurge of infection, but Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Missouri show very substantial upsurges of infection. It's based entirely on how much population-wide immunity you have based on vaccination.
There are myriad conspiracy theories out there which disagree with the use of vaccines for a variety of reasons. Even before the pandemic hit, the opponents of vaccination, commonly referred to as anti-vaxxers, were active. Today, they could create a crisis for the uninsured people.
Seem to presuppose somebody's authorization of the occurrence or something, but what I do know is healthcare is a necessity, right? People need to be healthy, and people, certainly in the United States, right, where we have food deserts and all kinds of malnutrition, poor agriculture, et cetera, you know, where disease is rampant, and especially in poor and African communities, we need oftentimes other people to take care of us. So, whether it's a right or not, I don't know if that's the fundamental question. As a matter of fact, I would say it's not. It's a necessity. It's an absolute must. And if we define right as a must, as a necessity, then yes, it's a right. But I don't know what the definition of right is for this particular conversation. But I also want to say to the question of competition, when you're talking about colonialism and the United States of America that's built on colonial capitalism, everything is commodified. Chairman O'Malley used to tell the talks about this saying where the capitalist will sell you the rope to hang them with. So everything in the United States of America is commodified and in that way set up for some kind of competition. But healthcare is an absolute must and a necessity.
The higher transmissibility of the Delta variant could complicate the situation in the United States, where some still refuse to get vaccinated. As of June 18th, over 45% of Americans had been vaccinated and some 54% had received the first dose.
Ingenuity of American scientists, the full capacity of American companies, and a whole of government response across federal, state, tribal, and local governments. Together, we built an unparalleled vaccination program and managed one of the biggest and most complicated logistical challenges in American history. And above all, we got here because of the American people stepping up and getting vaccinated, helping family, friends, neighbors get vaccinated. And just remember what the situation was like 150 days ago. We didn't have enough vaccine supply for all Americans. We didn't have the vaccine infrastructure or the people who administer the vaccines or the places where the people could get vaccinated. But we turned it around together by acting quickly and aggressively and equitably.
More costly healthcare processes are on the horizon for many Americans. The ups and downs of the vaccination effort indeed plays a major part in the lives of those not enjoying any insurance coverage, as well as many who are confused whether to opt for a public or private option.
The reason why the United States of America does not have some kind of a system that cares for subjects, colonized people, like Africans, like the indigenous people, and others who are here based on the terms the United States set for us, the colonized, is because the colonizers exist on, the whole existence is based on that exploitation. So, yeah, they are, if you will, the United States is developed, but their development depends, the sole existence of the development depends on the United States and the colonizers' ability to exploit and oppress those of us who are colonized, which means that they don't care whether we're sick if our sickness does not hurt their ability to maintain colonial power. So, you know, right now, they, the United States has this situation in place where they make money off of our sickness, and they don't, whether we suffer from illness or not doesn't hurt them.
Not having health insurance has made the pandemic harsher for many in the United States. Therefore, there are those who believe that health care is a right for every American rather than a commodity and insurance. They argue that health care is not a privilege, rather it is a right that everyone should enjoy.
Luca was born with alveolar capillary dysplasia and Hirschsprung's disease. At 3 weeks old, he had surgery to remove part of his colon. At 2 months, he went into cardiac arrest, and at 5 months, he had a lung transplant. His parents had to turn to fundraising almost immediately just to keep up with the medical bills.
They did a clamshell approach, and he has several scars from all of the other surgery.
So when did the U.S. healthcare system go from a philanthropic program to a multi-billion dollar industry? And where do the funds go once the bills are paid?
No one should die due to not being able to cover the financial costs of healthcare, and everyone should have access to the health services they need. Many believe that in the United States there is a system at work designed to deny, rather than support, the right to health.
Liberals and conservatives both believe in liberty. And how can you be free if your health care depends on your employment? Both believe in economic freedom. But how can you be free if medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy in the country? Now, both liberals and conservatives believe in a fair shake. But how can you believe in this system that does not include a level playing field and that relegates children who are poor to a second tier of healthcare from the time that they're born? And finally, both believe in equal opportunity. How can you have this if you are a sick person who suddenly is too sick to work, and then you lose your job, and then you lose your health insurance, and then you can no longer help you yourself and fend for yourself or help your family? So I believe that everyone in this country, liberal, conservatives, and everyone in between, believes that we should have healthcare that is based on need and not on your ability to pay, and that is universal, comprehensive, affordable, accessible, equitable, and just.
Some U.S. states have been obliged to move forward with the universal care coverage, most notably Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. The Affordable Care Act, or the so-called Obamacare, was also among such efforts with myriad ups and downs, from rejection in the Trump era to partial survival in the Biden administration.
2 years of campaigning, and I'm telling you, no matter where I went, people were suffering so badly with the ravages of Obamacare. And I will say this, that as far as I'm concerned, your premiums, they're going to start to come down. We're going to get this passed through the Senate. I feel so confident. Your deductibles, when it comes to deductibles, they were so ridiculous that nobody got to use their current plan, this non-existent plan that I heard so many wonderful things about over the last 3 or 4 days. After that, I mean, I don't think you're going to hear so much right now. The insurance companies are fleeing. It's been a catastrophe, and this is a great plan.
Donald Trump promised to repeal Obamacare, but the health insurance survived his repeated attacks. The former president enjoyed support in both chambers of U.S. Congress and even assigned Supreme Court justices, poised to overturn the insurance program, but all to no avail.
So the truth is that Medicare for All would not have prevented the COVID-19 pandemic. Many other countries that did have
we do have universal health care still suffered terribly from the pandemic, but it would have gone a long way to help people here in the United States. So we do know that more Americans died from COVID than any other country in the world, and all countries that spend less on healthcare than we do. Now, if the United States had a national single-payer healthcare system, there are some things that would have been different during the pandemic, for sure.
The U.S. Supreme Court, which appears to have the ultimate say over the issue, has so far refused to strike the ACT down, despite getting very close to it. Two of the three jurists Trump had appointed to the High Court, namely Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, voted as part of a 7-2 majority to deny claims that the law harms some states.
Majority Leader.
Ever since Democrats passed the Affordable Care Act, expanding health coverage and access to tens of millions of Americans, we've had to fight tooth and nail to preserve the law from partisan Republican attacks. For more than a decade, the assault on health care law was relentless from Republicans in Congress, from the executive branch itself, and from Republican attorneys general in the courts. In a landmark vote, we in the Senate prevented the Republicans from repealing the ACA in 2017.
After all, the Supreme Court had ruled in a 5-4 decision that Obamacare individual mandate is constitutional in 2012. With more liberal justices sitting on the bench at the time, the decision basically meant Americans would be fined through paying taxes if they did not apply to purchase healthcare insurance.
With Republicans, none of them, Democrat, Republican, what have you, they don't have the ability to say that colonized people, African people, have our own particular needs. We have our own particular, as a matter of fact, you will hear mayors, governors, and maybe sometimes even presidents say stuff like, they are the president for all the people. You know, they don't see color, stuff like this. The reality is, because those types of sentiments and that type of blindness exists among liberalists and conservatives, conservativists and what have you, African people and colonized people need to be able to do for ourselves what those blind people cannot and will not do.
With the U.S. health insurance struggling to exist in the face of opposition from many conservative factions, the U.S. government needs to put more focus and attention on this issue. The pandemic is taking fewer lives, but the vaccination is also lagging. The U.S. has been boosting the vaccination effort by offering incentives from free hamburgers to college scholarship.
It's kind of something in our history, in our DNA, that we desire to be free from government intervention in our lives.
From your perspective, you know, what's the vaccine choice debate about?
The parent should have the ability to decide whether or not their child takes medicine or receives an injection. It's about liberty.
So it's not about vaccines themselves or their safety?
For some it is. For me personally, it has nothing to do with the science or debating the science of vaccines.
Do you get vaccines yourself?
I do.
Do you have children?
I do. And they've been vaccinated.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up getting the flu shot every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's purely, but it was at my own choosing.
But even million-dollar lottery prizes are failing to convince the hardcore anti-vaxxers to get vaccinated, which could endanger the lives of others, particularly those with pre-existing conditions. As healthcare just becomes more important, the authorities are under more pressure to provide for the nation in the critical sector. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Please tune in again next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings upon our Master, Muhammad, and his pure, immaculate household, particularly the remnant of God on earth. May God's peace be upon Ali ibn Musa al-Rida al-Murtada, God's great guardian, in the amount that God knows, eternal peace as eternal as God's kingdom. I congratulate all the dear Iranian nation and all those who are eager to make a pilgrimage to his shrine on this occasion of the celebration of 10 days of Karamat, dignity, and the birth anniversary of Ali ibn Musa al-Rida, peace be upon him. Unfortunately, we have been deprived of making this pilgrimage for a long time. We are hopeful that God will increase his mercy and favor upon this nation due to the blessing of prayers and intercession of this noble Imam day by day. God willing, the blessings due to the Iranian nation being in the vicinity of this holy grave will increase every day. Going to talk about the elections today. In less than 48 hours, a determining event will take place in the country. That is the presidential election and the Islamic city and village councils elections. Definitely the country's destiny for a period of time in the areas of economy, cultural issues, security, health, and the like is dependent on what you, the people of Iran, will, God willing, do on the Friday. This means that with your participation, with your votes, you in fact will determine the country's destiny in all major issues. The great task that people will do on Friday is primarily to participate in the elections. The second thing is the type of participation and the type of choice. We hope God, the Almighty, will guide our hearts and the hearts of the Iranian nation so that we may participate in the elections in the best possible way. In one of my recent speeches with the nation of Iran, I mentioned that people's participation has a deep root and a firm intellectual backing supporting it. It is not just a political matter. It has many political benefits. But besides these benefits, and more important than these benefits, is the philosophy behind people's participation in the system of the Islamic Republic.
Alhamdulillah.
this tree.
Just like a fascist empire would normally behave, another unilateral move by the United States once more promises to affect lives of people around the world for the worse, this time in terms of internet freedom. In an expected move on Tuesday, June 22nd, the U.S. Justice Department seized 36 websites with links to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional allies for engaging in, quote, disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations, unquote. The move initially arose suspicions of a hack since a disclaimer that said this website has been seized accompanied an Arabic text as the one you can still see on PressTV.com, while State Department spokesman Ned Price refused to comment. The Empire's Justice Department eventually said three of the seized domains belonged to the Iraqi group Kata'ab Hezbollah, while the rest, including Yemeni, Palestinian, and Bahraini outlets in English and Arabic, were supported by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union. The seized websites obviously belonged to outlets of the allied resistance communities, better known as the Resistance Axis, that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the U.S. and regional rivals like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Try to keep a straight face here. The U.S. blacklisted us with designations related to terrorism. I kid you not. The mother of all terrorism, also known as the Empire, said that the American companies are not allowed to provide us with .com and .net domains without special authorization from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFA. U.S. fascist officials can choose to label it however they wish, yet they will never be able to change the fact that this seizure is a clear example of a systematic effort to distort freedom of speech on a global level and silence independent voices in media, which gives us and everyone included in this seizure the full right to pursue the issue through legal channels. While the U.S. may have given itself the ability to exert influence over vast sections of the internet, its actions will for sure have far-reaching ramifications beyond its control. Those unilateral harassment actions will only give credence to arguments of U.S. interference and censoring due to fear of being further exposed by native media in nations they continue to sanction like Iran, occupy like Iraq, and bomb like Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. More than 30 web domains linked to the Axis of Resistance, one of which is Press TV, were blatantly seized by U.S. agencies last week. The U.S. seized sites operated inside Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, as well as social media channels affiliated with the Iraqi resistance, the PMU. The seizures come as the Biden administration is in the midst of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear program and follow the election of a new president who has been criticized by Washington for being a staunch detractor of its imperial foreign policy. Now, the Iranian government condemned this act of censorship as unlawful and part of an influence campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. To discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media and a tech expert. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi. Now, visitors of the affected websites by the seizure, by the U.S. Seizure, were greeted with a banner that says that the domain name has been seized by the U.S. government as part of, I quote, enforcement action taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Bureau of Industry and Security. Now, if you want to define and maybe phrase this, just put it into words, how would you do that?
First of all, we need to understand one thing, which is that what happened was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized the DNS side of the website, not the actual site. So it's what tells the when a person browses for a site, he types a name. The DNS service is what tells the browser that this name belongs to this IP address. This link is what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized. That's basically what happened in the first part.
So that would you putting it into actual words, but that actual seizure from a tech point of view, how much time would have that have taken, and what would the tools be that they used to do that?
Since they have access to the actual DNS service from a local company inside the US, which runs these DNS addresses, they can do it easily with one court order. They can directly seize control on anything which is considered on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, had you an immigration and customs enforcement spokeswoman had declared when that happened before, it declared that this act of, we can call it internet fascism by the U.S., was performed that by the U.S. government because it has a right to seize the .com, .net, and .org domain names simply because the companies have the contracts to administer them are based on U.S. soil. If that is the case, wouldn't such actions urge people to move away from these domain names to try and at least protect their work?
Well, basically, they should understand. The people should start to understand that since there is no actual real internet governance, which is in unbiased hands, they should know that whenever they buy any of these domains, they are susceptible to being seized by the U.S. government. Knowing that, if you want to go to the legal side of it, the U.S. should only be enforcing whatever is ends with a .us. So it might be .com, then .us. Or, like, for example, in Lebanon, .com.lb, and whatever other country, .me, for example. It depends on which country. So each country can have access to its own domains if it was the unbiased way to achieve such a thing. But sadly, what's happening is that they have control over all the .com, the .net, even the .org, since the companies that run these domains are on American soil, and VeriSign, which is the company that runs the .com and .net, is very very closely tied to the system.
You mentioned VeriSign, Heidi, and it's a U.S.-based internet backbone company that has the contract to manage the coveted.com and other generic top-level domains, the ones that you just mentioned, and it has a very cozy relationship, and I mean cozy that's described by the U.S. media, not by me, with the federal government, with the FBI, and has long had a contract from the U.S. government to help manage the internet's root file, which is the key to having a unified internet name system. What would now stop other international corporation for assigned names and numbers from following suit of unleashing a global government crackdown on domain names that simply do not abide by Western values or Western narratives, or just simply are not liked by the US, the UK, or any other Western regime?
Again, sadly, we are at a point where nothing can stop such seizures happening in anywhere in the world, since they have ultimate access to all these things. There's the ICANN, ICANN. They were under American control for some time, and then they released that control, and they started making 13 multiple organizations governing each part of the world. They are non-governmental organization. They don't get paid by any government. And they are one step towards global internet governance, trying to make internet unbiased location. But still, the U.S. hasn't released its hand over these names. So we get to a loop where we are susceptible to have our domains seized at any moment just by being connected to any ideology or any political stance which is maybe anti-US or anti-West, or maybe not doesn't go well with US comprehension of things.
Or simply, if you're going to compete with the U.S., we did see that happening to a lot of also Chinese
websites where they were seized, they were put down. But I had a technical question concerning something that you mentioned about the .com.lb, for example. Is that more secure from the .com by itself? If I'm going to go with the .com.ir instead of just .com, should that be more safe than just going with the domain name .ir?
Your own country's domain, for example, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's the .ir, which is governed by Iranian law. It has nothing to do with American governance over the internet. So, of course, it's much safer to invest in your own domain. And maybe if you want, you can link a .com to it for SEO purposes, which later on might have other issues. But that's another technical path.
So you mean that only having a .ir might make it hard to find it on a search engine?
Yes, true. Because the crawlers work in a different way, and also the search engine itself might be biased. It might push things which aren't actually relevant.
Hello, Google.
Exactly.
Well, many outside the United States, like China, Russia, India, they distrust this U.S. cozy tech companies, especially with the big tech companies, the social media ones, and have been vocal about wanting to see control being shared all across the world, which is just fair, at least to say it's fair. Of the internet's naming system, they want to see it turned over to an organization such as the International Telecommunications Union, right, an affiliate of the United Nations. Now, look, once you say UN, I, for one, as a citizen of West Asia, I am a bit panicking once I hear the word UN. Why? Because it is an international body, but it's a biased body.
True.
So what are we actually doing here?
Maybe this makes it less susceptible to U.S. seizure, but in the end it will be biased. But since it presents itself as an unbiased organization, it gives us a range of movement to work with such institutes.
So it might actually protect domain names, or might just get them on board a certain committee that would have to study if that domain name
exactly
is used or not.
It gets them maybe on the side where, instead of having, like, for example, you sleep and then you wake up with 30 plus websites being seized, you'll wake up with a warning, and then things will start to take a bit of meetings from here, discussions there, debates here, until they get to a certain...
But wouldn't that just threaten freedom of speech?
At the end of the day, it is
a form of censorship.
Exactly, that's what's happening.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much, Hadi Shatila,
the
founder of iBreathe Media, for explaining to us what actually happened when the U.S. blatantly decided to take over our websites and the websites of our sister channels as well. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great content from you, Hadi. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what is going on in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Seems that death in Palestinian authority custody no longer differs than that of the Israeli occupation's use of ruthless excessive force against Palestinians during incarceration, and that's being said sadly. An outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority, who intended to run in the parliamentary elections before they were actually canceled earlier this May, died during his arrest in Hebron by Palestinian Authority forces on Thursday. Nizar Banat, 44 years old, was a harsh critic of the Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and called on Western nations to cut off aid to it because of its growing authoritarianism and human rights violations. More in this following report.
Hundreds of Palestinian natives continue to gather on a daily basis in the city of Ramallah to protest over the death of activist Nizar Banat after being dragged by excessive force out of his home on Thursday, June 24th at 3:30 a.m. in the morning by the Palestinian Authority security forces. Angry demonstrators gathered in the city of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, to chant slogans against President Mahmoud Abbas 2 days after Abbas's forces arrested and killed activist Nizar Banat. They carried Palestinian flags, photos of Banat, and signs demanding the fall of the regime. Protests were also held in Hebron and El Bire. Palestinian security forces then launched a heavy barrage of tear gas into the crowd of hundreds in Ramallah and attacked protesters and several journalists. Earlier, plainclothes security forces spread out among protesters as they marched from the center of Ramallah towards the presidential offices and closed off the intersection leading to the area, forcing shops to close. One video from the protest showed security forces in plainclothes dragging a protester across the road as they simultaneously beat him.
القيادة الفلسطينية التقليدية هذه اللي حكمت الضفة الغربية اليوم طول عمرها هيك بتتاجر بكل شيء.
But who is Banat and why is his death, which some is now dubbing as an assassination, so significant? The prominent Palestinian political activist and an advocate of free speech was known for his outspoken videos on social media criticizing the Palestinian Authority for its corruption, as well as its shameful security coordination with the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. A former member of the Farah movement himself, the de facto ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Banat had been campaigning as a candidate for legislative elections on the Freedom and Dignity list. The elections initially scheduled for May were postponed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in April. While Abbas cited the voting rights of Palestinians living in occupied East Al-Quds as a reason to push back the elections, critics have accused him of seeking excuses to avoid a vote due to his party's unpopularity. Banat was well known for his extensive knowledge of Palestinian political and social history, often recalling anecdotes about the Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO in the 1970s or the British Mandate of Palestine before 1948 in order to make his point. In May, bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas were fired at the Banat family home while his wife and children were inside. Banat accused ruling party Fatah of being behind the attack and called on the European Union to cut its financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. Banat had also accused the Palestinian Authority of perpetrating torture on political dissidents detained in its prisons. Hence, his sudden death while in the hands of the Palestinian Authority sparked outrage and dismay in the Palestinian streets, which many believe has triggered the inevitable downfall of the Palestinian Authority.
So with us to discuss this issue is Mr. Ali Murad, who's political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, just like that, a brief statement was given by the Hebron Governorate saying that Nizar Banat's health deteriorated while he was in custody when Palestinian forces arrested him from his house earlier on Thursday, and that he was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. This is definitely not the first case where we see a detainee dying while in custody of the Palestinian Authority security forces. However, this man was known to have faced direct threats from members of the Palestinian Authority. How come this matter escalated to a point that whoever arrested him ended up just murdering him?
Thank you for hosting me. Of course, martyr Nizar Banat was threatened nearly on a daily basis. He had told his friends and his family that he is receiving death threats weeks before the assassination took place. Nizar's problem is that he was outspoken. He never, ever was able to louder his voice when talking about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and all the security apparatus that Mahmoud Abbas rules the West Bank using it.